Today, I'm joined by MediaSoc Events Director, Emily Eves, for an interview with Lisa Armstrong, Head of Fashion at the Daily Telegraph. Lisa has published several books over the course of her career and has twice been named Fashion Journalist of the Year. She'll be sharing her top insights and stories with us, touching on her favourite fashion shows, the rise of ethical clothing, and post-lockdown fashion. I'm your host, George Phillips, and you're listening to Insiders, the Oxford University Media Society podcast. Lisa, lovely to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
So nice to be here.
So we're going to be discussing your career today. We're going to be discussing what coronavirus means for the fashion industry. First of all, I think it'd be really interesting for us to touch briefly on how you've got to where you are today. Doing some research, I came across your introductory article for The Telegraph.
Oh my gosh. Okay. Well spoofed, George.
I know, we dug quite deep. But you spoke very briefly about your childhood. And you said, where I grew up in Dorset in the 70s, fashion didn't really exist.
It didn't. It was really lovely in that sense, because there were no Kardashians to make you feel you had to inject your bum with something to be this shape or that shape. And I mean, there were shops, but in my nearest town, which was Dorchester, which is Casterbridge, in Hardy, loved. Yes, it was all very Hardy land around there. So there was a Marks and Spencers, but even in the 70s, that wasn't considered very exciting. So I think I wore lots of secondhand clothes that were given to me free by, glamorous neighbours. And it was just beautifully free of any pressure in that sense. But, jeans were out. My grandmother, who lived in London, had always loved clothes and was very, very glamorous. And I think that I just inherited that. And I was sort of started reading fashion books when I was quite young. But didn't know that you could have a career writing about fashion. I mean, weirdly, my parents always got the Telegraph, but I never opened it. So I didn't know there were fashion pages in newspapers. And anyway, cut a long story short, I read English and French at university. And I got involved with the university newspaper and hospital radio, not through any sort of proper altruism, I think. It was just like the idea of radio. And then because I couldn't get a job in banking. I mean, don't ask me why. I thought I knew nothing about banking. I didn't know what it was. I mean, other than, going to the Lloyds Bank to pay in my check every term. I had no idea. But that's what everybody else was applying for. It was the kind of hot career at that time.
The classic Russell Group progression, I think, isn't it?
Exactly. And so I did that. I applied, got rejected from absolutely everything. So a friend of mine sort of saw me down in the dumps and kind of filled out a form for me to go to journalism, City University. And I got a place. And actually at the time, because I was really down on myself, I thought it must be a really rubbish course if they're accepting me. I'm not going to do that. But I had no other options. And I thought, well, at least I'll learn. I mean, this is how long ago it was. I thought, at least I'll learn shorthand and typing. That can't, that's going to stand me in good stead. So I did it. It was amazing. And the best thing, I mean, it was mad. And some of the teachers were nuts. But and the pupils also were very peculiar, some of them. But I did a work placement. The first work placement they got me on was on, I think it was called Here's Health magazine. And it was in Teddington Lock. Okay, that's how at the apex of media activity it was, Teddington Lock, which is a suburb of London, very, very leafy, lovely, quiet suburb of London.
A
well-known media hub. Yeah, it's a very, very nice place to live, but it was not Fleet Street, right?
No.
Anyway, I'm sitting in this office on day three. They were so nice, the journalists on that magazine, and they so looked after me and tried to give me interesting things to do. And I think on the third or fourth day, I sort of looked up and stared around this office in Teddington Lock and just thought, I love this. This is what I want to do. And from then on, it was kind of just, you know, do what you can to get a job. And do you know, this is what people often say, oh, you know, I could never go into the media. I wasn't writing articles when I was 4 years old, and I don't have contacts. Well, nor was I, and nor did I. But you know, I got there. You do have to be tenacious. And I remember in the last few months of my journalism course, they were sort of encouraging us to write freelance. And I don't know why, because I was quite a shy person, but I had amazing sort of chutzpah, because I remember ringing up the Sunday Times saying, I've got this great story about models. I mean, you know, nothing changes in my purview. But and so they commissioned me, and it was just sort of, and another thing I remember doing was, there was a free magazine, a free glossy magazine in those days called The Magazine. It was actually a really good, well-edited magazine. And I think Helena Bonham Carter had just got her first film role in a film called Lady Jane Grey. And I don't know how, but I got hold of the number of her agent and rang her and said, I'd like to interview her for The Magazine. And I didn't have a commission from The Magazine. I don't think they knew me. But anyway, they said, oh, okay. And so I then rang The Magazine and said, I've got an interview with Helena Bonham Carter, which I didn't quite have. Anyway, somehow managed to, you know, finesse the whole thing. So it all came, that was my first ever proper commission. And I remember, this is how long ago it was, that with my first journalist paycheck, I went and bought a file of facts. Because you may not even know what a file of fax is, but there was no technology in those days. So this was my sort of ring binder leather notebook. And I was on my way. So what you have to do is just not be deterred by the fact that you don't have contacts. You have to make your contacts. And actually, in some ways, it's there's so many more opportunities now, because, you know, you can do a podcast, or you can do you can make a name for yourself on Instagram or Twitter or whatever. You don't need to wait to be commissioned.
Yeah, it's crazy kind of thinking the way it's different to get into it all now. I also wanted to ask, like, was it more that you wanted to just simply write as a career, or were you always, did you always have fashion in mind?
Oh, no, I didn't have fashion in mind at all, because even when I went to City University and did the course there, I don't think they weren't really putting fashion out there as an option, because this was back in the, oh God, I'm going to reveal how old I am, but it was like 85, okay? So there hadn't been quite the explosion yet of all the style magazines that newspapers now do, right? Fashion's a huge part of newspapers. It's a huge part of, you know, even The Economist has a supplement with a lot of fashion. That didn't exist, right? So I remember when I first got to City University, the tutor said to us, right, write down your dream career plan. Okay, so I thought, right, my dream is I want a job on Cosmopolitan, which was then the biggest selling women's magazine. Then I want a job on Harper's and Queen, which is now Harper's Bazaar. Then I want a job on Vogue, right? Wrote that down, my dream scenario, and the tutor took one look at it and threw it back in my face, and he said, oh, grow up and be realistic. And I often think of him now, because actually, I never worked for Cosmo, but the others, yep.
You're like, look at me now.
Yeah, look at me now.
You can feel nice and smug knowing that you proved him completely wrong.
Yeah, but also I think it's, and I'm not just being sort of, annoyingly English modest here. I was, on that course, I was not the girl the most likely to succeed by any reckoning. And I was just really, really quite mediocre. But I think it's a real, I really applied myself, and I was really determined to learn how to write properly, because I knew I could write, because I'd been told, even as a kid, you know, teachers would always say, ah, your maths and science are terrible, but at least you can write. So I really wanted to hone that. And I was really hardworking and I was, you know, quite ballsy. But I was also, I think, you know, reasonably nice. Tried to get on with people. And that's really key. I think sometimes people underestimate that, particularly in fashion, because I think they watch too much sort of The Devil Wears Prada. Yeah. And they think that they have to be obnoxious to kind of be a thing. And it's nonsense. You can't, you know, it's, you can't even be obnoxious now if you're brilliant. But if you're not brilliant, and most people aren't brilliant, then forget being obnoxious. You want to be someone who gets on with people and gets on with the job.
So not the Anna Wintour effect. Sorry.
You know, Anna Wintour's brilliant. Anna Wintour's brilliant, and that's. You know, but those days have gone anyway. I think in the past, particularly in the US, you know, I don't know whether you've read Tina Brown's diaries of when she was at Vanity Fair, but I, if you're remotely interested in the media, they are fabulous. And she met while she was at Vanity Fair. Vanity Fair was the most powerful publication in the world at that point, probably certainly in popular culture. And it had vast budgets. And there isn't a single person, a key person, from the late 80s and early 90s that she didn't meet. And, you know, it was, glossy magazines were the place to be. And particularly in New York, if you were editing one of those magazines, you were a star, and you could get away with behaving in a sort of diva way, but not anymore. You know, magazines are really going down like ninepins. And newspapers have had one hell of a fight, you know, for the last 20 years, really. And, you know, budgets are slack. You've got to be really nimble and you've got to be able to, you know, make things happen on like tuppence halfpenny. I don't know what that is in new money. What is tuppence halfpenny? 0.000% of a something. So being a diva is just, it actually just makes people laugh now at you.
Not the fact you want though, is it?
No.
But yeah, you just mentioned as well how magazines are, the way they're appearing now are changing and newspapers are doing more and more fashion. How have you found kind of doing both? Because I've read that you've kind of worked with Elle and Vogue and also The Telegraph and The Times. Like, do you find a key difference in the types of media?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I actually worked for Vogue in the end for about, oh my God, like sort of 25 years, I think, just because I worked there as a staffer for about, I think, 8 years. And then I carried on freelancing for them when I was at The Times and when I was at The Telegraph. But it's really difficult, I think. And I still do a little bit for Harper's Bazaar in America and the UK. It's very different because you're having to think 3 months ahead, and that was always quite a challenge. But these days it's very, very hard because, you know, you've got the internet and you can get a story up on the internet in half an hour. So I keep thinking actually how hard it must be to be editing monthlies at the moment during COVID. You know, they're working on their September issues now, or maybe they're working on their October issues, and we don't know what the world is going to be like. So how do you produce something that feels remotely relevant?
Yeah, because I got a little subscription to Vogue and it comes through every month. And even the April edition came through and there's literally no mention of COVID anywhere in the entire thing. And that was kind of right in the midst of everything. So I was really
Because that would have been put together, you know, at the beginning of January, I guess, or maybe before.
Yeah, exactly. So
I think it's really hard. It's really hard. I mean, personally, I when I first left Vogue and went to The Times, I was a bit traumatized because Vogue was all such a lovely place to work in so many ways that you would think it would be lovely. And newspapers sort of really cut and thrust and the news desk shout at you and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But actually, about 2 or 3 years in, once I'd kind of got over the shock, I just realised newspapers are so much more fun because you have to be really far. You're not trying to. So often when I did pieces for Vogue, especially when I did big interviews with designers, it was, this has to be the definitive piece, it's Vogue. You don't really think like that on a newspaper. I mean, sure, you want it to be good, but it's like, actually what you're trying to do is capture the moment. So, you know, whether it's Tom Ford or, I don't know, Kanye West or whatever, or you know, or Keir Starmer, you're trying to capture them at that, at in that hour when you're interviewing them, and root it in that moment, which is much, it's much more relevant. It feels much more relevant to me.
Do you think you've got more creative freedom almost, perhaps because you're not catering to this kind of very specific audience and you're kind of having a chance to just be a bit more playful?
So much more playful, so much more creative freedom. I mean, not at the moment, it's been very challenging because you have to be very careful about your playfulness, because particularly at the beginning of the lockdown, people were very frightened and they could misread your playfulness. I think my articles probably lost a bit of humour in the beginning. But you're constantly thinking, well, how are people feeling this week? What might they want to read about? Are they ready to start thinking about wearing or buying beautiful clothes again? Or do they still want to know, more practical stuff about how to dye your hair at home or whatever? Will they ever be ready for an interview with a designer again? Do they care or not care? All that kind of thing. But I find that very interesting.
It sounds like a more emotional relationship to it than a kind of clinical, okay, I've got to get this done. It seems like you're reacting to what people actually,
I think, feeling. It's very, I mean, what you want is that you want your readers to feel they have a relationship with you, and try and make them feel as though you're talking to them directly, really.
And do you try and be, I guess, do you try and leave your writing as open as possible? Because I found you said no waffle, no cliches, no fashion speak were kind of, you know, the like key principles.
Oh my God, and I think I'm really sort of hoisting my, you know, allowing myself to be hoisted by my own punch. I hope I don't ever, I hate fashion speak. It's just rubbish.
And what do you mean by fashion speak when you say that? Like when people use all the jargon and think they're...
Oh, God, you know, sort of stuff when people talk about, jargon, or, you know, when they just resort to cliches and just filler. Like, so often, they don't... do you know what? I think fashion writing has improved so much in the last few years. I think... I mean... there was a period, a long period, where, you know, every week you'd read a piece about, a trench coat, and it would follow such a formula. There'd be the history of the trench coat, and here's one to buy now from a very expensive designer, and there you go, ba-boom. And it was sort of lazy and it's not that I don't like history. I absolutely love fashion history, but you have to do it in a sort of, you have to do it with original interpretation or try to. You know, classic with a twist, all those kinds of real cliches. We'd really try and avoid those. Style icon is another thing. I hate people saying style icon. Or fashion icon when they're just talking about, you know, another influencer or
but I think you strike that balance really well. I'm saying that as someone who, you know, I take an interest in fashion. I wouldn't necessarily read Vogue, but like reading through your articles, they're kind of a really, really nice balance of informative, but also just funny and really nice to read.
That's so nice that you say that. Do you know what I what I love most, which is a bit weird of me, but I love it when, say, some 50-year-old, like, banker or, you know, or doctor, whatever, says to me, oh, I read that. I read your piece about Givenchy, which will be on the news pages. They wouldn't read it if it was on the fashion pages. But, you know, during the shows, we were on the news pages. And they said it was really funny or it was interesting or I didn't know that, blah, blah. And then I think, yes, because actually fashion... I don't just want to speak to fashion insiders. I mean, it's lovely. It's lovely when fashion insiders like something you've done as well. But I don't just want to be talking to 400 people.
I remember seeing the article you wrote about what the Tiger King will mean for fashion. I remember seeing that shared. I think it was on Facebook.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And it's just, I think it's really funny how that was just kind of circulating among friends, you know, who wouldn't necessarily have an interest in reading the kind of fashion section.
You know, that is a real, that's a bullseye for me, because obviously Tiger King was huge. And that's a way of, that's just a way of maybe tapping into a different audience. And that's what I kind of, I really like doing, you know, because the shows are really, obviously it's a big privilege to go to those shows or some of them, but that is, for all the money that's spent on those shows by the brands, and for all that we might fly, you know, halfway around the world to see a show, that's not what really engages the readers the most.
Do you think you've realised that more recently? I mean, I'm just thinking we've seen...
No, no, I've known that for ages. We know that because we see the figures very, very closely on our, you know, on our website. But the brands are wedded to doing, or they were wedded to doing those shows because that's how they know how to tell their story. And you can see why, because, you know, when you see a really creative show, it's a wonderful thing. And... you know, it's beautiful to be able to see the craft and the work and the creativity that's gone into a show. But that, okay, so for example, just at the end of Paris in March, while COVID was, you know, it was when COVID was really starting to take off, the Louis Vuitton show, he had a, in the, as his sort of backdrop, he had, I don't know, maybe about 300 actors, and they were dressed in historical costume going back, you know, 350 years, and he and then he fed elements of that into the show, the ready to wear, so you might see a ruffle, or you might see a Puritan hat, or you might see a sort of buckle on a shoe, and it was absolutely wonderful to watch. But actually trying to get that across to people who weren't there is really, really difficult, because when you looked at the pictures, all the actors in that, they were so sort of in the distance. So while it's a very, very fabulous for me, you kind of have to be there to get the full experience. And so I think maybe there might be better ways in the future of getting that excitement across to a wider audience.
Well, it's funny you mention the show as well, kind of the runway as this kind of expressive art form, because it's something I've been like looking into recently. Because I watched, have you seen the McQueen documentary on Netflix about Alexander McQueen?
Oh my gosh, yes, it's a wonderful documentary.
Incredible, yeah. And I got really like fascinated by that, because it shows the shows aren't just about showing clothes; it's a full moment.
I think, you know, McQueen was an exceptional designer, and that he truly was an artist who just happened to be working in the medium of fashion. And
yeah,
I'm this is when it's quite good to be old, because I mean, I went to McQueen's first shows.
I've been to
pretty much all of them. I think probably the only times I missed them was when I was on maternity leave, and they were absolutely incredible. But again, you're only seeing that now because there's a documentary.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, maybe 400 people went to those shows, maybe at the height 800 people. And what is really fascinating, I remember even years and years ago, it's not that I'm a prophet or anything, but I do remember going to those shows thinking, this is crazy, they put so much effort and energy into 15 minutes and no one's seeing it apart from us.
Well, that's what I find so interesting as well. It often seems this kind of divide between the public and their perception of fashion, and then the people who, kind of the elite people who have access to it. Do you feel like that's changing though?
Well, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because I think there's a side of fashion that's always liked to be elitist and purist. Actually, I've just finished writing something about the Met Ball, because that was supposed to happen on Monday night, and obviously won't be. And, you know, that used to be a very sort of stylish affair, I think, which was much smaller and probably a lot more snobbish, because it was just high society in New York going to it. And then, of course, it got opened up, and Kim Kardashian, who, I think this is really interesting, she had been banned from going to the Met Ball.
But suddenly,
in about 2013, there was a, I think somebody realised that, you know, whatever they thought, whatever Vogue thought of Kim Kardashian, she was a big draw to a lot of people. So, she, you know, and now it's become this kind of like reality show monster, where it's just about who can wear the craziest outfit. And so you get, you know, there's this tussle constantly going on in fashion. You know, what are we? Are we this world of rarefied taste and sort of artistic creativity? Or are we, you know, are we a big business where celebrity means eyeballs, you know? And there's a tension there the whole time.
Yeah, that's something I think me and George were speaking about earlier as well, especially because of now it's kind of exposing what fashion is, what we need it for in society. Because, I mean, I often thought about the whole haute couture, how those shows can run without necessarily selling anything to the public. Like, how, what is necessary in our society today?
Well, I mean, just very brief. I mean, couture sells to, like, you know, 200 or 300 people in the world who've got the kind of money to spend 50,000 on one outfit, right? So that's obviously very rarefied, but I mean, there's only about 8 real couture shows anyway, and they create a lot of publicity, so they're marketing tools. So, you know, maybe you see a picture from the Chanel couture show, you're never gonna spend that kind of money on an outfit, but you might go and buy the perfume. So that's how couture works. But I can't remember what the rest of the question was. What's the point of fashion? Basically, what's the function of fashion? I mean, I think particularly when it's all a bit grim and bleak out there, it's there to kind of elevate and distract. And I have really loved, even more than usual, looking at beautiful pictures from the 1950s or the 70s or whatever. I just, you know, there's the most wonderful picture that was taken in about 1945 or 6 by Cecil Beaton for Vogue, I think, and it's a model standing in some fashion outfit at the bottom of this sweeping staircase in a house in Mayfair that had just been bombed. And she looks amazing. And it's all about sort of rebirth, renewal, you know, the strength of the human spirit, the power of beauty. And I think at its best, that's what fashion is about. So, I mean, you know, while I haven't been putting on my pages over the last few weeks, buy this, buy that, you know, because, you know, that would be ridiculous. Because A, we're all at home, and B, people are feeling financially really insecure. And also, you know, maybe they're feeling, actually, I shouldn't be buying this anyway. I should be making a donation to,
yeah, you know. I think it's interesting that you kind of refer to that as like a piece of a fashion as an area of safety, like much of art we go to now. It's
exactly.
Kind of to look
and
to
I
for.
Think, and I also do think that I found this, that getting dressed in the morning, even if it's just you going down to your kitchen table for another day, in front of your screen on your own, I think getting dressed, you know, brushing your hair, maybe putting on some makeup or whatever, just really does make you feel better.
Yeah, for sure. For me, it's earrings. I have to have earrings and then I feel normal again.
Do you think we're almost realizing, though, you know, you're talking about routine, which I think is a really, really important point. Do you think we're going to realize that we don't need to be spending, you know, money every week, every other week on kind of fast fashion items, which we'll wear a little bit and then forget about? Do you think we'll be kind of more discerning afterwards, I guess, about what we're buying and where our money's going?
I really hope so. I mean, I think that was happening anyway, wasn't it? And, you know, Greta's made us all much more aware. David Attenborough, plastic. I mean, I think it's been, even fashion has realised this. And there are brands like Gucci. First of all the brands have pretty much banned fur. Now, I know that's a slightly confused area because, you know, fake fur is arguably not that great for the environment. But the point is, people have realised that the old status symbols, especially if they involve cruelty or releasing vast amounts of toxins into the environment, it's just really not cool. I think this has really speeded that up. I mean, when I've been talking to brands during all this, they're telling me that things like eco-cottons, and organic fabrics, you know, they've been holding up relatively well. You know, do you both know Allbirds, the sneaker brand?
Was it Allbirds?
Yeah.
I haven't heard of it.
Oh, okay, well, check it out, guys. So Allbirds is this Kiwi American brand that launched 5 years ago, and they made the sneakers using New Zealand wool and wool sneakers. And I don't think even the founders would say these were the coolest, most beautiful footwear in the world, although I personally love them because they're so comfortable. And also, can you imagine just wearing a woolen shoe? It's gorgeous, and you can then throw it in the washing machine. Yeah. Anyway, so they're very, very you know, sustainable. They're something like 98% biodegradable. You bury them in your garden at the end of their life and they will decompose.
Wow.
Okay, so that all sounds really do-goody and quite niche. What a sweet little brand. That brand in 5 years is now worth something like $1.9 billion.
Oh my goodness.
People want this stuff. They want to, and especially going forward now, I think they will want to, if they are going to buy something, because we're all going to be feeling poorer, we're all going to be feeling a bit guiltier, we're all going to be feeling a bit chastened, at least, you know, in the immediate future. So if we think it's actually doing some good, it's going to ease that purchase, isn't it? So I think it's, you know, I mean, it is gonna go in that direction. We have to go in that direction. But that doesn't mean that we still won't have dresses selling for, you know, £8. Because that's all some people can afford. And that's, yeah, you know.
That's it as well. I think as well, a lot of the kind of the upper end brands do focus on sustainability. Like I remember Stella McCartney released the Stan Smiths, and they were vegan, and I was like, oh cool, that's really cool, but they're expensive, and so that if you don't have that budget, you would just kind of resort to the unsustainable option. So
I think though the high street will do more and more, and also there's a lot of recycling. There's a brand I love called Arket, and I don't know whether you know it because they don't have that many stores. There's a couple in London, and they are part of the H&M group. And they do a lot of recycling, recycled wools and cashmeres. And I also the rental market, you know, will take off. It was already starting to take off, and the vintage is coming back again. But rental is going to really take off because I think one of the things that's been very popular through this, isn't it, is people doing wardrobe clear outs. And realizing how much stuff they've got that they don't need. So instead of buying clothes, it's, you know, it seems much more sensible to rent them, wear them, and then send them back. And because there's going to be all this unsold stock, there'll be a lot of offloading of that stock onto these bigger rental sites. So you'll be able to rent brand new stuff, basically.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I just wanted, before we end on this kind of deep and a sustainable chat, I wanted to ask a very superficial fashion question. I just wanted to hear, because obviously you've been involved in the industry for a long time now, what have been your most memorable fashion moments or runway shows or collections that have kind of stood out to you or meant something in your career?
Oh my gosh, that's putting me on the spot. I mean, okay, having said shows, they're so irrelevant. Two shows that were absolutely, many McQueen shows, but I remember he did one called Atlantis. And I remember coming back. It was the end of Paris, which meant that it was the end of 4 weeks of shows. And normally you get back and you're completely exhausted and you don't want to ever look at another show again. And I remember coming back saying to my poor family, you've got to look at this show because it was being filmed. I mean, he was very sort of technically ahead. And that was incredible. Another time I was in Capri for a Dolce & Gabbana couture show. And we were all sitting on rocks. And I mean, the clients are insane at those shows. They're so rich. And they were wearing, sort of tiaras, Dolce & Gabbana crowns and tiaras with no sense of irony. And the models arrived by boat, little rowing boats, and they were escorted ashore by these sort of hunky models pretending to be sailors, all wearing these very tight t-shirts. I loved that.
Wow.
I mean, memorable.
Sounds like a Bond scene or something. Yeah. Almost. I mean,
they're totally Bond. I mean, honestly, it's crazy, the excess and the extravagance. Another time I remember, I interviewed Alexander McQueen quite a few times, and he could be lovely, or he could be really, really scary and horrible. And I remember one time I'd gone to interview him, and he'd been sort of in between the two. And when I got back and listened, this was for the Times, and I remember trying to play back the interview, and it just hadn't recorded. That was horrible. That was really bad. You know what I learned from that? Always take two devices to record on. Yeah, I mean, there's so many fabulous characters. You know, Marc Jacobs kind of shouting at me. I mean, I didn't take it personally, but he was having a go at all fashion editors. I was interviewing him in Paris, and he said, "My God, you all criticize me, but look at the way you all look. It's just terrible." And a Tom Ford, love interviewing Tom Ford because he's so outspoken, doesn't really care what he says. And you know, I remember interviewing Tom not that long ago, actually, and he was kind of acting out some porn scene for me on the floor, and I just thought, I so wish I could Instagram this moment. I mean, God bless them all. Donatella Versace is always quite funny to interview and enjoy sending herself up. I mean, that I ought to have some really horrible moments. I mean, I do remember sort of almost missing shows. Oh my gosh, here's one of my really early ones. I was at the Independent, and it was my first gig as a fashion editor, and I was really, really tired. It was like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd had a lot of deadlines. I thought, I'll just go to sleep for an hour. I'll be fresh for the Versace show. The Versace show was a big deal. The news desk were leaving a whole half page for it, and I woke up and I missed the show. And it was like one of those dreams you have where you dream that you're naked in public. You dream that you're going to miss a show, but it's never going to happen, right? It actually happened.
What on earth was that call like that you had to make when you realised?
Because actually, this is where fashion people can confound you and be so nice. Hilary Alexander, who was then the fashion editor at The Telegraph, she was my predecessor, she said, "Do not worry, I will talk you through that show." Because don't forget, in those days, it wasn't all immediately up on the internet. There were no, you wouldn't see the pictures of the show. You missed it. Though she taught me through. So I don't think The Independent ever knew. There were many things that newspapers never knew that happened.
There you go, that's our breaking story then that we can reveal.
There was another time when I was at the Times early on in my career. I was quite, you know, inexperienced and hated doing the shows for the newspapers because the deadlines were so intense. And the Times used to send me off to do the shows with a staff photographer, and often they were war photographers. So they were used to being in Afghanistan, not in Paris. So they're a bit like pole cats. And I remember there was one, he was a really, really nice guy, but it was all on negatives in those days. No, they couldn't show you on their phones. We didn't have smartphones. So he, I remember he took me into the bathroom, turned all the lights off because that was like his dark room. And he said, right, Lisa, you need to choose 15 pictures now for the paper. They need to go now. And they were all just negatives. And he said, right, remember, the red is really green. The green is really blue. The black is white. The white is black. I did not know. I was having to just choose the pictures almost blind, really. God knows what it looked like in the paper. But yeah, the larks.
There you go. We've got a proper behind the scenes look at the early days now then.
Yeah, you sure have.
I think that's probably quite a nice note to end on then, isn't it? If everyone else is happy.
Yeah, I'm completely talked out.
A huge thank you to Lisa Armstrong and to Emily Eves for joining me on the show today. If you've enjoyed this episode, why not check out our website at oxfordunimediasoc.com or find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. That's all for today, and we'll see you again soon.